Good morning. Good morning, Atlanta. And people who are not from Atlanta. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of a loving God, good sponsorship, and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since March 6th of 93. And I got to tell you, I didn't plan. When I woke up on March 6th of 93, I did not plan on getting sober. I didn't wake up saying, I'm going to go to AA, I'm just going to get sober, I'm never going to drink again, it's going to have this wonderful life. That's not what happened. Before I launch into this torrid story, I want to thank the committee. And it is touching it. Okay. Are you okay, John? I love John. You know, I've been blessed to be John's sponsor for I don't know how many years now, but it's an honor to sponsor anybody, but John and Kathy are special to my heart, so I want to thank the committee for asking me. Everybody's been amazing. David, you've been amazing. You've been great. It's just been heartfelt. And I can just say this, whatever happens, say, we, a bunch of us prayed outside, and the prayer was simple for all of us, was just to help me get out of the way and help God flow through me. And so anything that's good, anything you hear that's powerful, that you get, that you think it's not me. You just need to know that. It's not me. All right? Anything good in my life has come through the power of God. And on the flip side, if you're in the bathroom outside judging me, saying I sucked, you're just judging God, and we don't do that in AA. So. Just know that, okay? My home group is the Smoking Gun Big Book Step Study in Dallas, Texas. I'm not from Texas. It's where I live. I don't know how long I'll be there, but God's in charge. I didn't plan on being there, but that's where I reside. Everybody, every speaker, every panel, everything's been amazing this weekend. You know, they always talk to Sunday morning speakers like, this is the spiritual. Well, after you hear my story, you're like, really? Yeah, the interesting word about the word spiritual, you know, everybody focuses on the word spirit. But there's another word within that, and it's called ritual. And a lot of people don't realize that. And I believe the rituals of the spirit is what binds us. And the rituals of the spirit is what allowed me to stay sober for the last 29 years. Because of my own doing, I just wouldn't be sober. There's just no way. A guy like me and many others, and not like I'm the worst, but I was pretty bad. And I'm grateful for everything. I'm grateful for the men who walked in my life and told me that I could live differently and I didn't have to keep going back to prison. And there's so much gratitude. And I'm just going to be honest with you. This is probably going to be about as raw as it gets. I'm not one of these canned guys who comes around and tells the same story every time. I just can't. I don't speak a lot. I speak, you know, I turn down more than I speak, but I believe, and this is in my heart, that the spirit of the language of the heart is spirit to spirit, heart to heart, and to be authentic. And there's nothing in my story that I'm ashamed of. There's nothing. And I remember speaking at the Gopher State Roundup up in Minnesota, which if you've never been, it's like 10,000 people. And there's a piece of my story that I hadn't really talked about. You know, there was 10 of us up in the room before, and we did this prayer, and I was going down the elevator with my former wife, and I said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to tell that. And she said, we just prayed, like 10 of us said, you don't know what you're going to say. And I told that story in front of 10,000 people. And it's a story that I never told anybody for 20 years in sobriety. And I remember when I told that story, and I don't remember what happened, but I remember in the greeting line, there's some guy in the back. I watched him. He was just broken. And he came up to me, and he just grabbed me. And the same event happened to him, and he never told anybody, and he's never been able to stay sober. And he asked me, he said, will you come and stand by me while I tell my sponsor what happened to me, which I haven't been able to tell? And I didn't have. I just stood 10 feet away. And so me to you, I'm just going to be authentic, okay? I'm just going to be tell the story of what happened, what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. I believe that the Kent last night, whenever I hear Kent, man, he is on fire, and he should be a preacher. I mean, he gets lights up the room. And so it's Sunday morning, and I'm going to tell you right now, I'm channeling Kent right now, because I'm going to tell you, We're all tired. I love Sunday mornings because the people that show up here on Sunday morning, they're the deal. People want to leave early, get out, get home and stuff like that. This is a whole conference all the way, from Thursday. I flew in Thursday. I flew in Thursday because I could take off. Some people can't take off work. I just, I work for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, Behavioral Health, and I can do whatever I want, which is weird. And so I came in early. And honestly, a guy with a convicted felon in high school education, I don't even know how I got the job. So, yeah. So I got sober on March 6th of 93. I'm going to tell you why. I don't tell my story linear. I don't know where it's going to go. God's in charge. I had been sober a year and 2 weeks. And I was working at a treatment center. And I had just got out of prison. I'd been out a year. And I got a job at this treatment center. They race thoroughbreds and quarter horses. And I get, the guy offered me a job at an Alano club. I was just getting out of this halfway house, and I remember I was 3 months sober, and I really wanted to be sober. And I thought because I wanted to be sober that I just the desire to be sober would keep me sober, like the third tradition, right? The third tradition doesn't mean you're going to stay sober, right? It's just the requirement for membership. So I didn't think I was going to do the steps because they had that thing called amends, and I had a lot of money, I didn't think you had to do that. I thought that was an option. I thought, just come to AA. And I got a year and 2 weeks, second AA meeting, coming out of the meeting, this thought popped in my head, you should go see what David and Jody are doing. We should just go see what they're doing. They haven't seen me in so long. And I know what they're doing. It's a crack house. And But I was just going to let them know how good I am and how my life has changed. And I had no plan of drinking that night. And I stepped in that door and I started drinking, right? See, it's not the first drink that gets me drunk. It's the unprotected thought that precedes the first drink. So I had no protection against that. There isn't a thought. I can't think my way through it. I can't play the tape through. Because I'm an optimist. I've always been an optimist. I never play the tape back to the penitentiary. I just don't do that. Why would I, right? I'm such an optimist, I thought I was going to grow to 5'8" in my 20s. I thought, really, I'm going to have a growth spurt, So what happened is, I'm working at this treatment center. I'm not a clinical, I don't do this. I'm just in the barn. I'm working in the barn, and I had a road dog named Max. And Max was my road dog, He's like a guy you run with, your first year of sobriety, your partners, you kind of run with, you hang. And he was like a Buddha surfer guy from California. And I was on my way to the dog track that night to hit the trifecta so I could party. Now, I'm in a treatment center, working in a treatment center with keys to the place. And I've been in relapse for 3 months trying to hide it. And I stood up to go, and he pulled in front of me, and he said, "Hey, Brian, I got a question." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "How long have you been sober?" I said, "Dude, I've been sober, you're at my year anniversary 3 months ago." And I started to walk around him, and he just stepped in front of me. He said, "No, brother, how long have you been sober? Like a day, a week, maybe not even?" And I said, "Man, I don't need this." And he just got right in my face, and he said to me the words that many people have said. He said, I love you too much to watch you die, brother." And on that day, at that moment, I had what is called a double surrender. Now, there's been many other surrenders, and I'm going to tell you some of them, but I think the two key surrenders that have to happen are surrender to the bottle and a surrender of my will. And they don't always happen simultaneously, and it happened at that moment. I broke down. I was 30 years old. I just spent 7 years in prison, my whole 20s, and I was a hard, now when I say hard, clearly, I'm not a boxer, right? Clearly, I'm not a guy that picks fights. I have a big mouth, but I always have big friends. And a lot of people don't. If anybody ever watched Bad News Bears? Remember Bad News Bears back in the day? Walter? Yeah, Matt. Yeah, I was Tanner. Tanner the shortstop? That was me. If you want to know what? Benjamin Button and Tanner. That's my thing. That's who I am. And that was the beginning of the journey to where I live today. Okay, that was the beginning of the end. And I never guessed it would be that day. I grew up in Stockton, California. Now, Stockton, California is a hard town to grow up in. And I'm a product of the 60s and 70s. I'm 60 years old. I know I look way younger than that. And I do know this. Short people have a longer shelf life, so I'm cool with that, right? Totally comfortable with that. It's a true story. Look it up. You can see it, right? I grew up in an environment where drinking was just part of our culture. My parents were beer can collectors. Their hobby was Beer Can Collectors of America. It's an actual organization. I don't know if it's still around, but my house was full of like old beer cans all around the wall. You know, it was like baseball trading cards, but they're actually trading beer cans. And they had canventions, and it was a big party. So the energy around alcohol, I love the energy around alcohol. I love everything about alcohol. I love the taste. I love the smell of a bar the next day. But most importantly, I love the effect. The effect of alcohol on me just changed. Just like it says in a night step. When I say Alcoholics Anonymous has done slowly for me what booze did quickly, that's what I'm talking about. If you looked at the nine-step promises and you replaced them with drinking, every single one of those things happened when I drank alcohol. The sense of, I could breathe, I could be part of. I literally was everybody I ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here. I had no idea who I was. I had no idea. I was asleep. I was completely asleep. And I started drinking young. It was part of the culture, and my poker games and my uncles, and it was just good stuff. And I'm going to tell you right now, I have a lot of good memories around drinking. I'm not one of those guys whose wall was like drinking was, you know, I had a lot of good times. The problem is it's so progressive and so slowly that it starts off like I think I have a choice, and I probably did in the beginning, but then one day I've crossed this line, I don't even know where it is, and I'm not choosing anymore. I'm not choosing to go into the liquor store. I think I'm choosing, I think I'm making a decision, but alcohol, this internal spiritual condition called spiritual malady, restless, irritable, discontent. I'm like a guy, like if I drove my car into the water, like by accident, right? I'm underground. I'm going to hold my breath as long as I'm going to hold my breath. But eventually, I'm going to have to take a breath. Eventually, I'm just going to have to open up. And I'm going to die. But I have no choice because of the pressure inside. It's the same thing with untreated alcoholism. I can hold my breath for as long as I can hold it, and I will hold it, and it's just all, and then it gets all over me, and eventually I just say, screw it. And I think I say I'm choosing to drink, and I'm not choosing to drink. This spiritual malady within me makes me drink, right? I'm a guy who says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in my spirit. Now, people will say it centers in your mind, and they'll even bet me, and I will bet them, and I'll win $20 every time. I know what it says in the book, but it only says, therefore, the main problem centers in the mind rather than the body. They don't even talk about it. 64 says something different. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And this, I drink to fix that spiritual malady within me. I drink for effect because I can't not drink. And my progression as I, you know, look, my brother died of COVID in 2020. This is a guy who molested me. I was stealing bikes for him when I was 10 years old. I was breaking into houses. He taught me criminal activity. He was a true sociopath, but he was my brother and I loved him. I loved him so much I couldn't be near him when he got older. I loved him so much that when I was able to make amends to him, even after that, I would call him and I'd be part of that, but I just couldn't get too close, okay? Him and some friends molested me when I was 10. I ran away from home when I was 12 with him and his friends. That's how, and I look back at that, I think, what is wrong with me? And I want to like make it all about me, and I'm warped, and I'm broken, and there's no hope, and it's not. I have this illness. It's called alcoholism. My parents, if you're from Stockton, it's called the Delta. You can take the Delta. It's this waterway all the way to the San Francisco Bay. We stole a boat. I was 12. They were 16. Problem with that is it's got salt water, and so the tide kind of... We basically dry-sanded. We hit a sandbar, and we got arrested. And I went to juvenile hall for about a couple of days, and they let me out. My brother got kicked out, and my parents moved to Tucson when I was 14. And there's nothing significant about that except at 14, I thought, you know what? I'm going to change my life. I'm going to get new friends. I'm going to start over. Nobody knows me. It'll be all new me. And I could stand that for about maybe 6 months. And then I started watching the guys go, and this is in the 70s, you know, 76. I watched the guys going across, you know, with their Aerosmith and their long hair. And, you know, I just started going where they went. And I started drinking again. And I don't think there's anything significant in high school that identified alcoholism to me back then, but you know, hindsight's always 20/20. And I used to go to keg parties, and I would. Here's my strategy. I call it strategy drinking. Strategy drinking is this. You go to a keg party after a football game, bring empty pitchers, leave them in the trunk of my car. My mom said, are you going to drink tonight? And I'd say yes. My mom would say, well, just sleep in your car, come home tomorrow, because my mom was an alcoholic. She didn't want me driving home drunk. God bless her soul. She probably saved my life. And but I never left the keg 15 feet. You know, I never, like, you never want to leap too far from the keg, right? So that goes. Who's got the timer? I need a timer, because I don't want to go too deep into my story without telling you the magic that God has bestowed upon me and which is capable of you. Is the woman, the young lady who got 2 days sober yesterday here? Man, I wish she was here, because I would congratulate her on her third day. 2 days she was here. What a blessing. The grace of God. Well, that's a little bit late. I grew up going to AA conferences. I just want to let you know. I had sponsorship even early when I got sober in 93. My sponsor, he was an area corrections chair. He was all in all three legacies. He was all three, and he took me to AA conferences. And I grew up going to AA. The first woman I heard was her name, Karen G. And Karen G has this story about super glue, I think, and some other anonymy. And it's a good story, but I remember sitting in the middle of 500 people listening to her story, thinking my life is over. You know, I'm 30 years old. Like, what do you do? How do you live life? How do you have fun? And I found myself laughing. And I'm like, what? I just laughed. And I started realizing that I could have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I love hanging around John. John, look at his shirt. All you got to do is realize, like... So my life progressed, all right? I graduated high school in 1980. I'm the type of guy, as soon as I graduated, I moved out with three other people, got a house, started working, living life, drinking daily, having fun, going to clubs, you know, skiing, trips to Mexico, just having normal 18, 19, 20-year-old, just having fun, right? I never got a DWI, OU, I never had any of that. I found myself parking on the curb, drunk, passed out sometimes, nobody caught me, but I never really got, so I could not identify alcoholism. When I was 21 in the early 80s, it was like 83, what I call like 2PC, it's called 2-pre-crack. It was 1983. I started getting involved in outside issues, and I started dealing these outside issues. And I'm not a good entrepreneur. I'm just not. You know, it's like a person that has an overeating disorder and they're like owning a cake shop. It's like it's not good, right? And so the reality is, you know, I got into this cycle of like, owing money to him, owing money to her, paying her, and it's a big cycle. A year of that, just constantly trying to dodge, and, you know, it got to an end. 21 years old, and this is why I love people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are young. If you're young in AA, I applaud you. I'm so grateful that you got sober young. It's the best. I do not like it when people say anything about people who, I spilled more, like, that is just disrespectful. Because I needed AA at the age of 21. I needed it as bad as I needed it when I got sober at 30. Because at the age of 21, I was done. And I went to, with my buddy, if you read my thing yesterday, I'm not going to get into the story, but I went to rob a Kentucky Fried Chicken with a buddy of mine. Didn't do it, didn't work, ate a meal, and went out to kill myself. What I didn't say yesterday was I took a piece of hose, and I'm not a depressed guy. I'm not a guy that, you know, there was a song back in the 70s called Seasons in the Sun. Anybody remember that? That was about the only depressed song I'd play occasionally, you know. It's about a friend dying of cancer. But I wasn't that type of guy. I'm not, like, dark, right? But on this day, I was done. And I remember cutting off a piece of hose and taking my roommate's car, and I drove way out into the desert. And I'm not, this isn't a cry for help. This isn't like, save me. This isn't like, look at me, I'm wounded. This is like, I am done. Done. The world does not need me. I'm no use. I have no value. I'm decrepit. I hurt people. I'm pumping fumes into my car. And I started writing letters. First letter was to my roommate. Hey, man, I'm sorry I killed myself in your car. That was a pre-amend. And I wrote a letter to my fiance, and then I started writing a letter to my mom. If you're at my workshop, I'm not going to you know the amend. I'm not going to tell you the amend, but I'll tell you. The truth is, my mom already buried my brother Chucky, and I watched what it did to my mom. I was awake enough to know that that would destroy my mom. And as many resentments as I had against my mom because of her alcoholism, as much anger I had at her for driving drunk with me when I was young and having an affair with my dad and smoking, you know, all the things that I had against my mom, the reality was I loved my mom. There was a piece of me that could not do that to her, and so I just stepped out of the car and walked around the desert all night like, what? Trying to figure out what my problem is. And that's a real problem, trying to figure out with this mind what my problem is. And so what I came up with, and there was a layer of truth. The truth is, lack of dilemma, lack of funds is my dilemma. Lack of funds is your dilemma. If lack of funds is your dilemma, then the only solution is money. And I just drove into town the next day and I robbed the bank. Now, people ask me, like, why'd you do that? I'm like, it's kind of obvious. I mean, bank. Money. All right, like, let's get clear. Right. I didn't have a gun. I wrote a note. It was a pathetic bank robbery. I got $50 on my first bank robbery. $50. A $50 bill. And I got it because that's what I asked for. I couldn't even make that up. In fact, if you want to talk to my former wife, she will talk to you about it. When we got sober, she wanted to see all the news articles, you know, because I was all over the news in Tucson that year, that summer. Judge Bilby, when I went in front of him to get sentenced, he called me a one-man crime wave. He said that. But the first article, everybody asked me, how much money do you get? You never tell anybody, $50. You're always like, oh, I got $12,000, I got $18,000. And the first article she read was about the first bank robbery where I got $50. And she looked at me and she goes, you're a liar. I said, yeah, and a thief and an alcoholic. I mean, like, what do you expect, you know? And I don't know why I did that. I was sober. It was a sober blackout. I went up to the counter, withdrawal, you know, to turn it over. Wrote, this is what I wrote. I didn't know I wrote until I got into my car and saw them. I wrote, I have a gun. This is a bank robbery. Give me $50 or I'll shoot you. This is what I did. And I want to let you know, just so you know, I'm a very polite bank robber. I'm a guy. I'm kind. I stand in line. I wait my turn. You know, they call me up, you know. And you hiding it from me? Okay. And I walked up to the counter, and she asked me, and I handed her a note, like, hey, you know, here you go. And she slides me a $50 bill. And then I run. Get my roommate's car, because not only... Now I'm robbing banks, my roommate's car, because my Pinto wasn't working, you know. So I saw the note, and I thought, well, that's just ridiculous. And so I went right to the 7-Eleven, got a 12-pack of Budweiser, drank about three of them, just get that sense of ease and comfort, because I just crossed the line and drove all the way across town and robbed another bank. And at that bank, what I did not know was the FBI was doing a bank training on bank robberies. They got the call for the first one, packed up and left. I drove across town and robbed that bank, and I got all the money I needed to pay all my bills, and then I just went on my life, showed up to work next day like nothing happened. Nothing. 6 months later, painting houses, asked my boss for his, hey, I got to cash a check, can I borrow the keys? I drive into town with the work truck, rob a bank, show back up, you know. It's like, I'm thinking, why isn't everybody just doing this? Because they just kind of give you the money. I mean, they just give it to you. They're like, they hand it to you. What I did not know was that after you do three bank robberies, or even two, the FBI starts to get it, they get mad. And so I, 2 weeks later, I came home from work. And here's how I know alcoholism. Here's how it is. If you can relate to this, if you're struggling, like, am I alcoholic? Am I not? This is one of those little milestones, a little signpost that said, this is me. Or, you know, I never drank in the morning, alright? Now I did other things in the morning. I never left sober. I got so baked I could barely see. But I never drank, and my roommate drank. I'm like, man, if I'm like Steve, I may look at my drinking. He drank in the morning. I didn't. But around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm starting to get twisted. I'm starting to get tight. I'm a little bit irritable. Nobody's doing anything right at the job. It's frustrating me. And a half hour before we're leaving, I start to get a little bit lighter because I know I'm going to the liquor store and then I'm going to a club. And on the way, as soon as I get in the car on the way to the liquor store, I get a sense of ease and comfort even before I drink. And if you can relate to that, you may be alcoholic. Okay? You just may. And I don't label people. My sponsor never labeled me alcoholic. I used to ask him, you think I'm alcoholic? He said, shoot, Brian, I don't know. And he'd tell me how he felt and how he drank. He said, if you can relate to that, you may be, but it's because it's a self-diagnosed to my innermost self. I came home and my picture was in the paper that day. I didn't know it, but my roommates cut it out. It looked like me. It was me. I knew it was me. My roommates thought it looked like me. Cut it out and put it on the refrigerator, and I pulled it down. I threw it out on the table. I said, "What's that?" And they go, "Dude, man, there's some dude running around town robbing banks looks just like you." And, you know, so don't worry. I'm just going to go for 4 hours. Don't worry. My plane will leave at 4:20. And I say that only for this. That shares you how out of character that was. That the guys that were running with me could not even imagine that I would do that. And it was so bad, it was so much pressure on me, because the paranoia, see, paranoia are just facts that haven't been, they haven't been confirmed. Really, that's really what paranoia is. They're facts in my mind. They just haven't been confirmed. And so they'd send me to, "Hey, I'm going to go to the liquor store." It would take me an hour and a half to go to the liquor store because I knew I had these bank robberies, and I thought the FBI was following me, so I'd stop, I'd run around. I mean, literally, it was ridiculous. And finally they said, "You can't go anymore." And 2 weeks later, I got arrested. Thank God. Thank God I got arrested. Got bailed out. Parents got me a lawyer. They got me everything that parents do. I would do it for my daughter, and I do it for my son. And then my lawyer said, "You're going to prison for 10 years. And I just said, "Well, what's the use? When you're 21, 10 years seems forever. If I'd have known I was going to live to 60, I may have had a different plan. I doubt it. And that day, I just, it was a Friday, and I told my roommate, "Hey, can I borrow your keys? I got to go cash my last check." And I don't know, my roommates were just silly. They just gave me his keys, and I went and robbed another bank. And I got arrested on Monday, and I went to prison for 6 years, okay? And the significance of that, I didn't want to be sober. When you're 21 years old, turning 22, you're 5'1", you come from the suburbs, and you're getting sentenced to 6 years in the penitentiary at a federal prison. There's this fear that creeps through me. I ended up in this place called Milan, Michigan. And I am writing a book called The Angels That God Sends Your Way. And I have a whole list of them. And a lot of them I met in prison. And I had to run through my first 2.5 years in prison. That was just, I learned that I had to stand up for myself. But I was making wine, I was buying weed, I was doing everything you could do. I just didn't want to get sober. And then a couple guys, I got in about 5 or 6 fights in my first month. Kept going to solitary, come out, and then some guys stepped up. And one of them was a guy from Cleveland who was a gangster, mafia guy, named Tommy. And Tommy Sonito, he's dead now. He died in prison, and he pulled me aside, and he made a gesture to me of kindness and love, even though he was this cold-blooded killer. I didn't know who he was. I knew he was in the mafia, but I didn't know anything about him until Wikipedia came out. Late years later, I realized really what a dangerous man this one man was, but he brought me under his wing. I think he was redeeming himself. I think he treated me like a son. He was 45, and he taught me how to play handball, and I had this instant protection. And I had another gentleman, same thing, and then they both went away. And then one day, I never told anybody for 20 years. 20 years I never said this. One day, I was in my cell, and I was going to the yard to lift weights with my buddy, and I was going to meet him on the yard, and I turned around, and there's these four guys, inner-city Detroit kids, and this one guy had a beef with me, and I don't know why he had a beef with me. Maybe he just thought it wasn't fair that nobody was taking my stuff. I have no idea, but he didn't like me, and I turned around, and all I know is my nose got broken, and I got raped by four guys. And I don't remember anything but laying on that ground. Wanting my mom. I used to have a lot of shame around that until I started to watch and talk to, my dad fought in the Korean War, and when people are in war, you'll hear them, they're crying for their mom in the pits as they're dying. That was inside of me. And my cellmate saw me, and he wanted to take me to the hospital, and I said, "I'm not going to the hospital." He said, "Well, then you gotta take care of this," and the next day I took care of it. And this isn't a racist thing at all, man. This is just life, man. This doesn't matter, white, black. It doesn't even matter. Man, it just happens. People hurt people. And the next day, I hit that guy in the head with a pipe. I almost killed him. I'd be in prison right now if it wasn't for my cellmate who said, "You got to stop. Let's go." And I ended up going. I was covered with blood, and I got sent to Terre Haute, Indiana, which is now going from the frying pan to the fire. And I owe that man an amends. It just came up because they kept me in solitary for 9 months to see if this guy was going to die. And I caused him great brain damage. And I'm already in the midst of trying. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I owe this man an amends. I owe him. Because what I was taught in the spiritual world is to set aside anything they've done and look for my own mistakes. And there are people who have told me, you had to do that and you had to do that. And that may be true for them, but I want to live a spiritual life and I want to live a life of God. And I almost killed a man. 9 months in an 8x10 cage. 9 months by myself. Years later, when I did some therapy outside, outside help, I was doing this trauma work stuff, and my safe place was my cell because you couldn't get me in my cage. It's safe. That's how sad it was. And 3 months into that, I was at this place where, I'm 26 and 25 years old. I'm thinking, I have nobody. No one loves me. I'm sitting there alone. I'm a broken man. I'm a hard man. I have a shell. You can't get close to me. I have no feelings. And the guard comes in and says, "You have a visitor." And I went out to the visiting room, and this is 3 months, and this is how God's timing is. I was at that time where I thought about hanging myself in my cell because I was alone. And I walked in a room, and my oldest brother, Dwayne, had flown from California to Terre Haute, Indiana, to visit me. And he didn't know why I was there. My mom didn't know why I was there, because I'm not going to tell her that. I told her I got in a fight because somebody stole something from me. And he came on the very day. My thought that week was, why not just end it? And I walked into that visiting room, and I knew I wasn't alone. My mom and dad have died. My other brother's died. Dwayne, the one who visited me, it's just him and I. And a year and a half ago, he got diagnosed with stage 4 glioblastoma. Untreatable brain cancer. And I remember telling him that story. He didn't know anything about that story, and he broke down crying, and his wife... My brother's very analytical. My dad's an IBMer. We have a very, analytical mind. My brother never shed a tear. My sister-in-law, after I told him what happened to me in prison and how that event changed things for me, my brother got off the phone. He just couldn't do it. And Marcy said, "I've been with your brother 15 years. I've never seen him cry. And he's back. He's in the backyard just bawling." When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they were talking about having this relationship with God. I'm thinking, well, where was God in that cell that day when those guys came in and did that? And here's what I know. That's the absence of God. That the absence of God, because like this guy Don P. told me, God's a perfect gentleman. He'll never come anywhere he's not invited. If you don't invite him, he will not arrive. He's there for you. Grace, unaccepted, is nothing. Grace, everybody in this room right here, right now, is in this space of grace. Failure to accept the grace is what the problem is. See, and accepting grace for me has been to do the things that God wants me to do. To show up, to suit up. Take responsibility. Get on this path. Live a different life. Take the actions. I'm fairly obedient to God. Fairly. Nobody's perfect. Okay. I have, in the last 29 years, not invited God into some situations in my life because I think I have an answer or I will, and really it's based on this. I don't want to get honest about that because if I get honest about that, I'll look bad. He may leave me, she may leave me, they won't like me or whatever it is. I never had a problem with God. When I went through the steps, I never had a problem with God. I had a problem with the concept of God that I created. I created this God that everything's like supposed to be butterflies and angels, and everything's supposed to be perfect and nothing bad. Well, when your brother dies of leukemia at 7, you're molested at 10, and you're raped when you're 26, it's really hard to have a relationship with that God. And I had to create this God that is just love and kindness And the world is the world, and people act the way they want to. People that don't have God in their life act the way they want to act and do the things they want to do. But if I live this spiritual life, if I do the best I can to live in the spirit of God's love, no matter what comes down the pike, it's going to be okay. I may not like it, but I'm going to tell you, the fact that I've thought about drinking numerous times since I've been sober, and the thought, when it pops in, it pops right out. 10-step promise, we recoil as if from a hot flame. Earlier on, it talks about we're like, we go to the stove, we keep touching the stove. We're stove touchers. We keep touching it like, oh, it won't burn me this time, you know. Like, how many times am I going to touch this stove? It has to be like that for me. And when March 6th, when that guy intervened and made my drinking his business, they called the owner of the treatment center. He said, "What's going on, Brian?" And I said, I've been drinking and using for the last 3 months. He said, "Well, you can't work for me." And I said, "Okay, I'll pack my stuff and go." And he said, no, son, you don't need to go. You just can't work for me. If you want to be a patient here for 3 months, you can come back and work in the barn. Are you willing to do that?" And I said, "Yes, I'm willing to turn in my keys." So when you're driving the van, we're driving the buggy to the meeting, and you got the keys, and you're in the staff housing, and all of a sudden you got to turn that in and go into their housing, and you got to sit at the back of the bus. That's called willingness. Okay? And I was willing. I was like willing to do anything. And I had a sponsor that was the best sponsor I could have had, because he knew I was defiant by nature. And if he was one of those, Kent had a different sponsor. It was great Kent said that. He needed someone that boom, boom, boom. He needed that. I didn't need that. I wouldn't have accepted that. I needed someone that could love me enough to say things in a way that I could hear. No judgment, no telling me what to do, giving me options. Kenny, the reason I got Kenny, Cowboy Kenny, because he used to say this in A meetings in Tucson. It was a big thing. Somebody brings up a problem, and nobody really has a solution. They're like, "Well, I don't know." Someone will say, "Well, this too shall pass." And, you know, and that's code for, "We don't really know, but hopefully it'll pass." And, but Kenny would say this. He would say, "Well, this too shall pass, but if we don't get down to causes and conditions, this too shall return." And that man, 2 days later, I went to my first A meeting, the first one being the sober, and he gave me his big book, and he sponsored me, and he walked me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as it's outlined in the book, line by line, and I walked through, and he, you know, there's 51 pages in the big book to talk about the first step. Doctor's opinion, first 43 pages. All about to know, am I an alcoholic? Am I a real alcoholic? As defined on page 21. Am I a real alcoholic? Well, I don't know if it's in 21, but it's in there somewhere. But I'll tell you this. I'm not a moderate drinker, and I was a hard drinker, but I'm a real alcoholic. Once I start drinking, I have little control. I have no control over the amount I take. It's a crapshoot. And I got in the second step, and that was the key in the second step for me was, am I willing? Do I believe, or am I willing to believe there's a power? If they didn't have that willing to believe, I would have been stuck. And I said, I'm willing to believe. And the third step, you know, the way you turn your will and your life over to the care of God, the only way is the actions through 4 through 9. That's the, if you read Frank Buckman, the founder of the Oxford Group, you'll find out. If you ask anybody who wrote the very first four step, very few people ever say Bill Wilson, Ebby, Roland Hazard. Frank Buckman, a non-alcoholic, wrote the very first inventory. If you want to read the history, that's the guy who did it. He wasn't even an alcoholic, and he wrote it, and he created the 6-step process, which became the Oxford Group, and then that became where we're at. And I'm telling you right now, those steps cleared away all the records, cleared away the vessel for me to have a relationship with God. You know, I sponsored a monk in AA once, and he was a monk. He was a real monk. I was like 7 years sober, and this guy, he had this like sandals and jeans and a burlap thing and like a little monk outfit and a wooden cross, and everybody was whispering, like, "Have you seen the monk?" You know, I'm like, "No, but I want to see him," you know. So I went to your AA barbecue, and I saw the monk. I'm like, "Oh, I'm going to talk to this guy." And he was 14 years sober, and he says, after about an hour conversation, he says, "Will you sponsor me?" I said, "Yeah." "How long have you been sober?" He said, "14 years. I said, "Well, I've been 7. He said, "I don't care. Will you sponsor me?" I said, "I'd be honored." Show up to my house at 6 o'clock on Wednesday morning. And I called Don P. up. You know, actually, I called a guy named Tom I. first. And then he said something, and I called Don, and I said, "Don, I'm sponsoring a monk." And he said, "No, you're not." And I go, Yeah, Don, I'm sponsoring a monk. He goes, no, Brian, you're not sponsoring a monk. I said, Don, let me just say it a little slower. And he said, no, you're sponsoring an alcoholic whose vocation is something different. And if you treat him like an alcoholic, then you can help him. But if you treat him like a monk, it ain't going to work. And Don had taught me, he was never my sponsor. I remember asking him to sponsor me, and he said no. And I don't know why, but he lived in Colorado. I lived in Maine. I didn't take it personal. Okay, lie. But, you know. But I still called him every week because, you know what? It doesn't matter. I'm just going to call you anyway. And you don't have to call it that. I still had a local sponsor, but, you know, I called him all the time. And he taught me about this vital sixth sense, this intuition, the whispers of God. And like he said, and I believe, God never screams at me, never yells at me. It's very, very whispery. It's very soft. And if my house is clean, if my spiritual condition is clean, I can hear the whispers of God. And that morning he was coming. I was down in my basement, 20 minutes doing meditation, getting quiet. Please, God, let me. And what God told me as I was walking up the stairs that day to get him, and it seemed the most ridiculous thing, and I just kept having Don saying, listen to the whispers of God. And what God whispered to me at that moment was, don't let him wear his monk outfit into your house. But I didn't say it like that, but that's what I said to him. So he knocked at the door, and he had his little outfit, and I said, hey, nice seeing you, Andy. I got some coffee on. We're going to go in the basement and see you got your big book. I said, but you can't wear your little monk outfit. And he's like, what? I said, yeah, that little burlap thing, you know, like the sandals and the cross, all good. But the monk outfit, you got to take that off. I said, you got a sweatshirt? If not, I got one. He goes, no, I got one. He went out and this is equally arrogant. He got a Dartmouth sweatshirt, you know. And he came in and I'm going to tell you, I spent a year with this man. As we journeyed through the 12 steps, and then he got Lyme disease. I was living in Maine. Him and I built pastures. We had a horse farm. We spent the whole summer building paddocks for my wife, my former wife. And I learned more about the history of God and the history of religion and what he said to me after he went through this process and he was making amends. He came up to me one day. And he used to go into the prison and carry, you know, he was doing his service work. I mean, he did AA, but he was going in there and doing Bible studies in the prison that I was doing 12-step work with. And we were in the parking lot. We just happened to meet. And one day, he came and he gave me this hug. He said, I don't know how God works, Brian. I still don't know. I was going to be a priest. And then I said, I realized I didn't want to not have sex. And so I, he says, but I just want to say something to you because I'm moving. I got to move to Arizona because I've got this condition. But I've never had a relationship with God until you took me through those 12 steps. And I want to thank you for being available to me. And I want to thank you for treating me as an equal. Not as someone who knew more about God than you did, because I think you know more about God than I do. And maybe not in the literal sense, but in the actions. He goes, I watched you every day after we would get up from our step work and you would go make your kids French toast and you would get your kids ready. And I watched how you operate and you're more Catholic than you know, which scared me. I was like, well, like, simmer down there, you know. And when I moved to Maine, I was a year sober after I moved to Maine, and I got involved. And I'm a guy who believes you should do. I don't believe in the circle and the triangle is unity, recovery, service. And a lot of people think service is sponsoring people. They think service is going into the hospitals. I have a different opinion. Going into the hospitals, going into the jails, that's 12-step work. That's part of my recovery program. Service work is what the committee, that's service work. The people doing all the registration, all that stuff, GSR, DCM, all that kind of, that's the service work. Now, people can debate that, but I'm just telling you, 12-step says carry the message. If I go into the hospital carrying the message, I'm carrying the message. I'm doing 12-step work. Service work is when I got a job at my home group making coffee or greeting people at the door. That's service work. Right? You disagree all you want. Doesn't matter. I'm at the podium. I can say what I want. But I believe, and I don't believe everybody has to do Third Legacy. I don't believe everybody's. I think I should introduce all my sponsees to GSR. That I think that's necessary. But they all may not want to do it. But some sort of service work, intergroup, answering the phone calls, something like that, I think is important. And I've been surrounded by people who taught me that. And I was there Is that how long it's been, or is that how long I have?
That plus about 10 is how long you've spoken.
That's not good. Can you minus that 10 minutes? So I'm going to tell you some really cool stories that I think are cool that happened to me, and I believe that what we do, you know, because the first time I had Don do a big book workshop, I remember it was like 1996, and our home group did this little weekend retreat, you know, and we're out to 4-H. It's like this campground, and Don's going to come there, and he's going to do this. He's going to like enlighten us about the book, and we all got our highlighters and our pens, and he just chuckled. And if you knew the man, he had the bluest eyes. He had Paul Newman eyes, man. And he was a kind man. And he chuckled. He goes, "Oh, isn't that cute? Y'all got your highlighters and your pens." He says, "We may not even crack the big book open." He says, "I'm not a teacher. I'm a storyteller." The very first of the book, the story of how many thousands of men and women. We tell stories. We sit around a campfire. We sit in rooms like this and we tell stories. Yeah, when I'm one-on-one sitting with you, we're going through. There's some of that teaching stuff going on, but it's just sharing the directions. But what we do here is we tell stories. I don't care how you do the 12 steps. I don't care if you use 12 and 12. I really don't care. None of my business. If it is my business, then I should look at the third step. Like the minister who sighs over the sins. If everybody would just do as he wished. The big book thumper who thinks everybody, it would be just great if everybody just did the steps the way he thinks he should do them. And I want to let you know, I am a big book guy. I'm a literature guy, straight out of the literature. Four column inventory, you know, sex ideal. I do it all. I do it exactly as it's laid out. But I don't care what you guys do. It's none of my business. If I start caring what you do, then, you know. Now, if you're a male and you come into my home group and you start preying on our newcomer girls, the girls in my group will take that. They will step up to you, okay? And if it gets too bad, I may have a conversation with you. Not a threatening one, but just say, "Hey, can you allow, you know, because I think we need to protect each other within Alcoholics Anonymous with love. Confrontation without love is cruel, okay? The truth without a real solution is brutality. If I'm going to give someone the truth about their behavior, if I don't give them a solution, that's brutal. I didn't invent that. I stole that. A lady came up to me. She was her name is Prison Lady Mary. She was the area corrections chair for Area 28 up in Maine. And she said, she wanted me to go into the prison. "You need to go into the prison." And she like stalked me. She literally stalked me for like 6 months. And I tried to avoid her because I didn't want to go into the prison because I had this other thing that I had not dealt with sitting there. I'd go into the county jail and I'd go into the hospitals, but I did not want to go behind the walls. And the prison in Maine was like Stephen King's from Maine. And I'll tell you, that prison, Thomaston, it was like, it was, basically, remember that movie, Shawshank Redemption? It was written after that prison, even though it was that. And finally, I caved and said, "Okay, I'll fill out your paperwork." And I filled it out, and guess what happened? They declined me. And you know what? I went on a writing campaign. You know, the warden, the commissioner, the governor, I just went wild. You know, it's like, I don't want to go to your party, I just want to be invited to your party. And I started to go into the Maine State Prison. And they had a Sunday morning meeting. It's called the Ledge Group. It's one of the oldest AA meetings in Maine. It started in 1950. And I went in their meeting on Sunday mornings. It's their meeting. They do it. And I realized quickly, like, this is not a real AA meeting. There's a bunch of crew who have kind of sabotaged it and taken control, and they're doing what they want. And I called up a guy named Tom I, and I said, "Hey, Tom," I told him what was going on. He said, "Why don't you start a meeting on a different day and take men through the 12 steps so they have a spiritual awakening before they leave prison? Because gate conversion doesn't work. You know, just going to lots of meetings inside and all of a sudden you leave prison, I'm going to be a different man, does not work. If they do not have, because a spiritual awakening is this. It's simplistic. A personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. I mean, that's what it is. The man I was 29 years ago will drink again. That's just a fact." He said, "Why don't you take men through the 12 steps?" I thought it was ridiculous. He called Don. He said the same thing. I thought, okay, these guys are in cahoots. And I asked Don, "How do you do it?" And he said, "Just talk to the guy." I asked the guy. I said, "Hey, can I come in on a different day and take men through the steps?" He said, "Absolutely. What day can you start?" I said, "Talk to my boss." I said, can I give up Fridays from 8 to 11? I'm going to go to this prison." And he said, "Absolutely." I was a salesman. I was the number one salesman. He said, "Dude, you keep selling the way you're at, you can take 3 days off. I don't care. As long as your numbers don't slip." And I went in that prison for 15 years, taking groups of men through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm talking groups, like 10 of us, 15 of us, through the book and into a group third step. And every group, I did probably 100 third steps with these guys. And I'm talking every single one of them, every time. I give them the dignity to do it however they want. And I'd say we can hold hands, we can just sit here and do it, or we can do it like I do on the streets, where we kneel, we hold hands, and we do the prayer together. Every time, they'd kick the table back and they'd say, we're doing it like you do it on the streets. And there's something powerful about having a group of men whose society has tossed aside, and you're holding hands, kneeling, and there's a window, and all these other convicts are walking by, and some of these guys were hard guys from the yard, and they didn't care because they wanted to be free. And I'm telling you right now, I did more fifth steps in that prison than I've done on the street. I did so many fifth steps. Guys that with FTW carved in their forehead, tattoos all over, knee to knee, because when you give to a man, when you kneel to a man and you get knee to knee, and you show no judgment and nothing but love, that's what they need. I don't look at the outside and society. We've all done stuff. I've seen grown men. These guys are like on the yard, hard guys, benching 500 pounds, you know, squatting 600. Like the hardest of the hardest get in a room. They call it Brian's Fifth Step Room. I'm not responsible for that. I don't take credit for that. All I take credit for is following direction of somebody and allowing God's power to flow through to me. In the last 3 years, I've been through the hardest 3 years of my life. It's been so hard. I'm going to tell you a story that I don't talk from the podium much. I got divorced. I got divorced in 2020. Chloe was my soulmate. I'm responsible. She's not responsible. I got honest about some stuff that I knew was going to end my marriage. And I'm not going to blame my trauma. I'm not going to blame all that. But things were seeping out of me, and it was getting dark, and I was having night terrors. I was thinking of committing suicide, and I started doing behaviors that are not conducive to spiritual life. And because I'm a type of guy who tries to fix it myself, and I got an image to control, then it was the worst thing, and I destroyed a marriage. I'm going to tell you a story. I went to this place for trauma treatment, and I came out, and I called my sponsor. And I told him what I've been doing. I said, I'm going to get honest with Chloe, and it's probably going to end my marriage. We got sober together. Our whole life, 26 years together, two beautiful kids, my daughter Quincy Blue and my son Max. Max is named after the guy who made my drink in his business. When Max intervened on me 6 months later, he started shooting heroin. He's never drawn a sober breath, and I've been sober since. And when my son was born, when I was 44 years old, I named him Max. I look in my son's eyes, and I know that he would not be here if it wasn't for a man who interfered with my drinking. And I did this prayer. Called my sponsor, and I said, hey, I'm going to tell her. And he said, well, wait for a day, and let's talk tomorrow and the next day. And what I learned was, this behavior, I wasn't willing to invite God. I kept thinking, I'll just stop it, I'll stop it. And I wanted to stop it. It's such against my character. And I got suicidal, and I went to my boss and said, I'm about ready to kill myself. And he sent me away to this place. And I came out, and that's when I sat down and I did this prayer with my sponsor. I said, God, I've never really trusted you 100%. And I'm ashamed of that. You have given me everything. You took a broken piece of a man and you gave me this life of usefulness. You've allowed me to be of service to so many of God's kids when I thought I was used to no one. And I'm going to tell Chloe something that will probably end my marriage, and I won't blame you, and I won't say that God doesn't exist and God wasn't there, but I only ask this one thing, that if she can't get through and she can't forgive and she has to do what she has to do, that you be with me, because I don't know if I can handle it. And I told her, went to marriage counseling, and I just stepped back, and I just said, you know, like, I wanted her to process what she needs to process, and I didn't want to manipulate that. I just wanted to let it be. I took responsibility and moved out of the house in 2019, and that fall, she said, I just can't get through, and I said, okay. And April of 2020, a friend of mine from AA called me and said, hey. Now, we were in the middle of our divorce, so this is not, no dig against any of them, right? Because we were moving on. And he was a friend in AA, and he said, I just want to let you know that I've been seeing Chloe. And I went about as dark as I've ever gone. And I called my buddy Jeff G. There's a great guy named Jeff G. And I called him up to 10 Step and I said, I want to kill him. I told him, I said, and he said the kindest things. He said, Brian, I love you. When I was newly sober, you sponsored me for so long and you're like a brother to me and I'm really sorry you're going through that pain, he said, but can you imagine how hard it must have been for him to call you? You're his grand sponsor. Because I hung up on him. When he called me, I said whatever and hung up on him. And I got off the phone with Jeff and I called that guy back and I said, I was wrong for hanging up on you. Me and Chloe are divorced and she can see whoever she wants and it's none of my business and I was wrong and it won't happen again. I only ask that you treat her with respect and love and be kind to her. And that night, at 3:30 in the morning, 26 years sober, I'm in my apartment. I have a second floor balcony, overlooks the parking lot of my apartment complex. It's my haven. It's where I got plants everywhere. It's like where I live. I love being outside because being inside, it's tough for me. 3:30 in the morning, I couldn't sleep and I just couldn't see it. And then I was done. And I have two beautiful kids. The most selfish thing I've ever thought was, what's the use? And I got this bed sheets and I made a noose and I was done. I texted Chloe and her phone's never on. And I texted her and said, tell the kids I love them. And I'm so ashamed of this. I just want you to know, 26 years sober, don't think that life is just great, okay? Because things happen. And I walked out on my patio. And at 3:30 in the morning, there's some guy right below me, 20 feet from my balcony, moving into his apartment. Like, who does that? What, like... And he was slow. I mean, he was, like, slow. It took me about 3 minutes to understand what was going on. It took me 3 minutes to realize God's saying, you asked me for help, and I'm not done with you. And it would have destroyed my kids. My daughter, her name is Quincy Blue. We didn't know we were going to have a daughter. I always wanted a daughter. I've been around men my whole life. And there's something around females, and it's not sexual. It's just that softness and the kindness and the heart within. And we didn't know we were having a girl. And I remember it was a C-section because we tried to have a home birth. I remember when they pulled her out, and he said, you have a beautiful daughter. I broke. My daughter lives with me. She's 20. She won't live with her mom. Not because she doesn't love her mom, just because she doesn't want me to be alone. How much I would have hurt her. I just can't believe I was there. And I sat there smoking a cigar for 45 minutes and like, this guy, just... That says I got about 10, 15 minutes. I'm going to tell you a couple more stories. So what happened is I went into sleep. 10 minutes later, four cops pounded on my door because Chloe had seen it. She called for a wellness check. And when I made amends to her, the two things that meant the most to her was one, that I did not invite her in emotionally to my pain, to my night terrors and all the stuff I was going through, and that she said, please don't ever, ever send me a text like that. It would kill our kids. They adore you. Last 2.5 years, at my darkest moments on my couch, I'd get a call out of the blue from someone from the prison. This guy I took through the steps, maybe in the prison, called me up. Hey, I was just thinking about you. Because I taught them to do the same thing. When you think about somebody, if you're going home today and you think about somebody, I beg you to call that person. Okay? I'll tell you why. There's a guy named Sean P. And him and I were spiritual competitors. You know, your early sobriety. I got more sponsees than you. You know, like, you know, early sobriety. Like, I've got 12. Oh, yeah, well, I got 9. And I got 13. You know, just lame, arrogant stuff. They told me one day that Sean went out. And so, and I liked Sean. We were friends. So I called him. I called that guy for a year. 1 year. And sometimes it'd be five times a week. Sometimes it'd be once a month. And whenever God said, call Sean, I'd call him. And finally it got ridiculous. I'd be like, hey, Sean, I know you're at Motel 6 with a bunch of hookers and crack, right? But and you're probably not going to call me back. And I hope I didn't ruin your buzz, but I love you. And if you ever need help, you know. And one day, Sean called me. Okay? And he's crying. He said, hey, I'm in detox, man, and will you come and see me? And I was like an hour and a half, 2 hours away, and I said, I'll be there. And I got down there, and I just hugged this guy, and he was just broken. And I said, John, there's hundreds of people around here. Why did you call me? He said, you're the only guy who called me continuously for the last year. So I'm going to tell you this story, and I'll probably end with this. Let me tell you, my life is good. Okay, I have a really good life. I have people that love me dearly. I have people, I'm a flawed man. I'm willing to do whatever I need to do to make things right. I've been, where I've come from a homeless shelter, from the penitentiary, to a marketing firm, one of the best sales reps there, to own my own marketing firm, to a CEO of a treatment center for 8 years, to now working for the whole Pro Football Hall of Fame Behavioral Health. You don't get there of your own power. Tom said luck is when hard work and opportunity cross paths. And that's what I do. I'm a hard worker. 2012, my dad, I love my dad. My dad was an angel. And I, this is the last story you're going to hear from me. Well, I'll tell you one other. Well, I'll tell you the story first. Yeah, you always hear that. This is the last story. Like, I swear to you, there's going to be two, and this is really quick. When my daughter was seven, and this is one of my favorites about how precious my daughter was. My daughter was 7 years old, and we used to ski. Me and my buddy Chip, his son was Quinn, and he was 4 months older. So Quinn, and Chip's in AA, we're just good AA people. And we'd all go, and we were going to ski that day, and this is in Maine. It's like a two-hour trip, and I told Chloe, I said, I think I need to tell Quincy that I've been in prison because we got all these inmates are coming out, and they're staying sober, and we're all telling war stories and having barbecues, and like she didn't know. And I got down on my knees in front of my baby daughter. She was seven, big blue eyes, and I remember kneeling in front of her, and I said, hey, sweetie, I need to tell you something about your dad. And she said, what's that, Daddy? And I said, you know, when I was in my 20s, I had committed some crimes, and I spent 7 years in prison. And my little girl just started busting out crying. She just cried and cried and heaved. And I thought for a second, like, too soon? You know, I mean, that's really what my thought was, like maybe damage this idea of who I was as her father. And she wiped her tears. I said, what's going on, sweetie? And she looked at me and she said, oh, Daddy, you must have been so lonely. And then she just came up and said, is that why you're going into prison and help Dickie and all these other guys? I said, yeah, sweetie. And she just gave me one of those hugs. And you know if you're a parent. She said, I love you, Daddy. I'm so proud of you. This is the story that wrecks me every time. And I would think, you know, Don died in 2005. And I'm so grateful that he gave me this gift about listening to the intuitive whisper of God. My dad was having strokes. They thought they were little strokes. 2014, he was about 79, in and out. Sometimes you go to these little care centers, they try to take care of him. And then I came out of meditation. I moved to Texas to be the CEO of this treatment center, and Chloe and the kids were in Maine, so I bought this house, and it was just me, and I came out of meditation, and God said, go see your dad. Go visit your dad. And I called my mom. I said, hey, I'm coming to town. She said, no need. He's fine. He's in bed. He's just dehydrated. The whisper, go see your dad. You must go see your dad. And I got on a plane and I flew out and I walked in and my dad was dying in my mom's bed, in their bed. 46 years married. My mom sees what she wants to see. And I climbed into bed with my dad and I remember wiping the sweat off his forehead. And I said, hey, Dad, it's Brian. And he just looked at me and he said, son, I'm so proud of you. I love you so much. I said, I love you too, Dad. Last words he said to me. And I, that whole day, take him to the bathroom, cleaning him up, and he was just a mess. And I called 911. We took him to the hospital. And We were up there, and they said he had bladder cancer. It wasn't stroke, said he was dying of bladder cancer. Nobody had seen it. He had months to live, if that. And we're all sitting there till like around 10 o'clock at night, and they ask us to leave. And as we're leaving, I look down, and my dad's toenails, nobody had been taking care of my dad's toenails. They had not been clipping them and cleaning them, and they were growing over. And I saw his feet. My dad's he's a vet. He was a father. He was a husband. He was a kind man. And I was so mad that my family, my brother and my uncle and my mom hadn't been taking care of my dad. And we went down the elevator, and it was the same thing, the same whisper. Go back. Clean your dad's feet. We got up to the parking lot, and they all said goodbye, and I went back up. The nurse said, what are you doing here? And I said, look, I don't want to cause a problem, but have you seen my dad's feet? And she said, I have. I said, look, my dad can't die like that. I don't want any trouble, but please, if you just give me some toenail clippers and a bin so I can wash his feet. That's all I ask. I'll be quick. That's all I ask. And she said, I'll be right back. She came back with two toenail clippers and two bins of soap and water, and then me and this nurse, who I'd never met before, sat down for the next 20 minutes cleaning my dad's feet and washing them, and all I remember is telling stories of what an awful son I was and how much pain I caused him. And we cleaned his feet, and we tucked him in, and I kissed him on the forehead, and I said, Dad, I love you. And I started to walk out the door, and the nurse grabbed me, and she turned me, and she got right in my face, and she said, I don't know about any of that, son, that you talked about, because that's not what I just witnessed. What I just witnessed is a son who loves his dad clear and completely. And then she hugged me. I never saw her again. You know, my dad's eulogy, my mom asked me, will you do your father's eulogy? Not my older brothers, me. And when I got out of prison, before I went on the run, because I did 6 years, and my dad got me a job with one of his best friends, and I violated my terms. I was a work truck. I stole money from him, and I made amends to him and cleaned it all up. And I did not know this was going to happen, but the day of my dad's funeral, the day, I couldn't get out of the chair. I just could not get out of the chair. It was so hard. I had to go and give the eulogy to my dad. It was just on me, and I get a phone call. And I don't recognize the number, and I answer it. And it was the guy who owned that place that I stole from, made amends to. It was my dad's good friend, good golf buddy. And he'd see me years later, and I answered the phone, and he said, hey, kid, how you doing? And I said, I'm not doing good, Al. He goes, I imagine. He goes, Al, you want to tell you something, son? He said, I can't come to your dad's funeral today because I'm down in Mexico. My son was just murdered 2 weeks ago, and we're trying to figure out what happened, but Kathy's going to be there. It's not because I don't love you or your dad or your mom, but I wanted you to know something today, and you need to hear me, son. I golfed with your dad up until he couldn't golf anymore, and every Sunday after we golfed, we had lunch, and every Sunday, your dad would talk about how proud he was of you and how much he loved you. And that's God working through you people to me, to you. And I'm blessed to be here. Thank you very much.